e a ka aha ho o kolokolo kiki hanohano ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is reconvened. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Case number SCWC-16-712, Grace Chen versus Jonathan William Ma, DDS, Jonathan Ma, DDS, Inc. Arguing for the petitioner, Mark G. Valencia. Also appearing for the petitioner, Stephanie Segovia. Arguing for the respondent, Dennis W. King. Argument on the merits.
All right, Mr. Valencia, Ms. Segovia, and Mr. King, are you ready to proceed today? Valencia, you reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning light at that point. Mr. King will give you a warning 5 minutes ago. Please proceed.
Thank you, Ryan. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Associate Justices, thank you very much for agreeing to take a look at this case. I think it does raise significant policy questions regarding how experienced lawyers deal with pro se parties in default situations. And I think that when you look at the analysis that the court is supposed to use, focusing on first the supplemental briefing that the court asked us to do, which I think was directly on point, that's the most important issue in the case. When you are looking at a default situation, I think you start with the longstanding policy that all doubts are resolved in favor of a trial on the merits, and that that defaults are highly disfavored, that trials on the merits are of course what you're trying to accomplish. And before you even look at the facts of this case, the court asked us, you know, what are the elements and who's required to prove what elements in the supplemental briefing question. And obviously I think the move-ant in most situations when they're asking for relief, they have to provide some argument. So there's a burden on the move-ant, no question about that. But also in a default situation, especially when you're dealing with a pro se party, the circuit court has an obligation to go through the analysis. And the analysis is the three-part test in the BDM case: prejudice, meritorious defense, and inexcusable neglect. And I think that when you're dealing with a pro se party, it's incumbent on the circuit court to go further than either the pro se party has done or even the party's lawyer, because we don't want to get into situations where you have a lawyer who basically gets outsmarted by another lawyer, outmaneuvered by another lawyer, and you wind up with someone losing their right to have their day in court, and that's sort of what happened here. So if you look at the particular test and how it was applied here, first of all, prejudice is not an issue that Judge Chang found no prejudice. That's not on appeal here. But regarding the meritorious defense, you had first, and I should have done this in my brief, and I apologize for not doing this, but I didn't highlight in my brief as well as I should have Dr. Ma's declaration, where he talks about defenses, where he talks about how the issue is, does he owe Dr. Chen money? And I didn't mention that Dr. Ma is present in the courtroom today, Your Honors. So the issue that he pointed out was whether or not he owed her money, and the answer was no. And he had a declaration from Gloria Thompson, who's an accountant, who said no. She went through her own calculation. She determined no. Actually, Dr. Chen owes Dr. Ma money. So what happened at the hearing, when you look at the hearing transcript, is Judge Chang said to prior counsel, well, what defenses do you have in this 12-count, 131-count complaint? What defenses do you have? And prior counsel said, well, the fraud claim. And so they talked about fraud. And then that's all they talked about. So when you look at the transcript and then when you look at the order that came out, the only issue that we know for certain the judge addressed was fraud. And I think that's really a mistake by the circuit court, because the circuit court, first of all, should have started with count one. And I think if you're doing a default analysis under the BDM test, under that second factor of meritorious defense, you have to look at all 12 counts.
So you seem to be conceding that Rule 50, a motion to set aside entry of default and a motion to set aside default judgment is evaluated under the same standard then?
I think it is, Your Honor.
So that's what the rule says. What does Rule 55B say? is B or C?
C.
C. For good cause shown, the court may set aside an entry of default.
Right.
And if a judgment by default has been entered, may likewise set it aside in accordance with Rule 60B. Do you think that the standard should be the same for setting aside entry of default and setting aside entry of default judgment? Shouldn't the standard be much higher? Doesn't the rule seem to recognize that, that you have to go through the 60B analysis on a to set aside entry of default judgment as compared to entry of default?
Yes, Your Honor, although I think 60B still requires a good cause standard, and there is no...
But that's not the question. What about the other requirements that showing a legitimate defense, a meritorious defense? Where does that come from in Rule 55?
It doesn't. It comes from your interpretation of 55.
But it appears that the trial courts are requiring satisfaction of all three prongs of the BDM versus SAGECO standard in order to set aside an entry of default.
Yes, Your Honor.
But is that what BDM versus SAGECO actually says?
That's my reading of the case, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it true that all the case recognizes that the showing would be much lower, though, for default, entry of default as opposed to judgment, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think once you're, yes. So setting aside the entry of default, definitely a lower standard. Setting aside a motion for default judgment is typically after there's been an evidentiary hearing. So I think clearly the burden's going to be a lot higher at that point. But I don't think that that's the issue in this case. We're talking about the circuit court's failure to set aside the entry of default.
Let me give you a possible scenario, because I guess what I want to know is, could the same justification in one case be satisfactory, but in another case not? So here's the scenario. Let's say, you know, we've been having what's been happening in California. Let's say your house burns down, okay? And because your house burns down, you're unable to file an answer in time. So you submit, so in two different cases, the defendant submits a response saying, hey, my house burned down, that's why my, I was late filing my answer. But but that wouldn't be a justification significant enough for having your house burned down, because you'd have to show a meritorious defense. So in other words, you could have the same reason, but in one situation, the court could say, well, you know, I'm going to look at your defenses, and you don't have a good defense, even though your house burned down. I'm looking at your defenses, and therefore, I'm not setting it aside. And in the next court, the judge says, well, yeah, your defenses are okay. I guess I'll set it aside. Does that seem logical? And does that seem to satisfy the purpose of the rule?
Justice Pollack, under that scenario, no, it doesn't sound fair at all if someone's house is burned down. Although I think it would be a mistake to just completely do away with the meritorious defense analysis.
Why? If the focus of the rule, this is a clerk who's putting in a default, a ministerial kind of action, mm-hmm. because you didn't file, somebody's saying you didn't file within 20 days, and we're going to say that having your house burned down, in one situation it's okay, and in another it's not. And another thing that really concerns me about this approach that we're taking is how does a judge determine whether a defense is meritorious? I mean, is this a summary judgment standard? What's going on? Is a judge just sitting, looking at a declaration of an attorney and deciding what's meritorious and what's not?
And this could be like 3 weeks, you know, I mean, 20 days, you don't file an answer. Default is entered on the 21st day, and then you got to wait 10 days. You file your, the defendant moves on the 22nd day to set aside entry of default, and the judge is like, oh, do you have a meritorious defense? Before your answer is even filed, before any discovery has even been done. Is that the standard that should apply?
For setting aside entry of default, Justice McKenna, if you look at the BDM case and the case that was, one of the cases that was relied on, it That case says that defendants must state a defense good at law, which is sufficient if it contains even a hint of a suggestion, which proven at trial would constitute a complete defense. That's a really low standard. So I think if someone just can articulate, basically, here's my defense, and it provides a hint of a suggestion, I think that satisfies.
I just want to get back to the language of the rule, and it says good cause, right? Good cause is defined as a substantial reason, one that affords a legal excuse. We have said that it's a relative and highly abstract term. Its meaning must be determined by the context of the action and procedures involved. It's basically, you know, if the standard is good cause, as the rule says it is, what substantial reason, what reason that would afford a legal excuse would your client have had to not respond and not move to set aside the default for such a long time?
I think in the context, Justice McKenna, of this case, you have to look at the communications that started with the demand letter. So first there were communications between Dr. Chen and Dr. Ma.
Okay. We couldn't find any communications after the complaint was filed.
Right.
So what happened between October and, what was it, May? What happened?
June.
Yeah.
June.
So I agree with you that in the record there is nothing clear that there were communications after October 3rd, 2012.
Was there any discovery?
Discovery was served, but I don't know that there were document exchanges after that point. But I think, Your Honor, if you start there, it's not a complete analysis. I think you have to start with the communications that began with counsel and Dr. Ma, and there were extensive communications. And if you take his declaration,
Between October and May or June, we see no evidence of any communications. And the last communication was, you know what, this isn't going anywhere. I'm going to advise my client. We're going to go ahead and pursue litigation. I'm going to file a complaint. When you retain an attorney, please have your attorney contact me. And there's no communication after that.
Yes,
that's Justice pretty clear, isn't it?
No, it's not entirely clear, because I think I'm talking about context. I don't think you can start in the middle of the story. So if you start at the beginning, when they got a demand letter in September of 2012, there were numerous conversations between Dr. Ma and Mr. King, where Mr. King is telling him, hey, look, just negotiate with me. We can resolve this. Don't worry about litigation. And
we're aware of that. Okay, so please tell us what happened after October, after the complaint was served.
Well,
what was happening? We don't see any communications. Was there discovery, informal discovery being performed? What are we talking about? What was happening?
So the short answer is we don't know exactly, because the record isn't clear in that regard. So
but isn't it your burden to show a substantial reason? I mean, isn't it your burden to get on the record something that would show that there is a good reason?
Justice Pollack, I think so. That's what I've been trying to explain to you, that I think if you look at the context, and when you have a lawyer who has 37 years experience, you have a litigant who's not a lawyer, and the lawyer is telling this person, look, if you just cooperate, we can resolve this, and then there's documents exchanged.
But Mr. Valencia, at some point in time, there was a motion to set aside default.
Yes.
Well, I guess the question is, what happened, what was the cause that made him move to set it aside, and whatever that reason was, why didn't he do it sooner?
The motion for default judgment is what I think caused him to hire a lawyer at that point. I mean, clearly, he should have hired a lawyer at the beginning when he first got contacted by an attorney, but if we're analyzing this as a layperson, from a layperson standpoint, I mean, if you look at the number of conversations they had, even on the date that the complaint was filed, and Justice McKenna referenced this email from counsel saying, I'm going to sue you. The email said a whole lot more than that. It was a very long, very complex email, and at the end he says, okay, I'll see you in court. But on that same day, the record shows 37-minute phone conversations between these guys. You don't spend 37 minutes telling someone, I'll see you in court. So I think, according to, and I know, according to Dr. Ma, he was being told, look, cooperate, let's negotiate, and so he was being disarmed.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to get clarification about what your point is about your interpretation of the nature of these communications. So, Mr. Valencia, is it your point that Mr. Ma thought during this eight-month period when he was between the complaint and there was a motion to set aside the default, during that period, Mr. Ma thought negotiations were still underway? Mr. Ma thought that there was a kind of communication going on that misled him to believe that they were negotiating?
Justice Wilson, all of the what I'm saying, no, not exactly. I'm saying all of the communications that led up to that point is what caused him to be disarmed.
Disarmed him? What does disarmed mean? He felt that there really wasn't going to be legal action taken or that they're still involved in negotiations? What do you mean by disarmed?
That he wasn't going to have to litigate this matter. And I think it implicates what I mentioned briefly in my briefing, the issue of lulling. And lulling isn't directly on point, but I think it's relevant. So you have a case where you have embraced this theory that any time someone does anything that causes someone not to file a lawsuit and the statute of limitations expires, the statute is told. I think the same concept applies here. Anytime you have a lawyer with 37 years experience who's talking to a non-lawyer litigant, telling him, look, let's negotiate, give me documents, and there's tremendous document exchange and communications.
Mr. Valencia, what was Mr. King, he asked Dr. Ma, do you have a lawyer? And my understanding is Dr. Ma said, I've talked to a friend, a lawyer's going to cost too much, I don't want to hire a lawyer. At that point in time, what is Mr. King supposed to do? Just not try to negotiate and stay out of court? We always encourage negotiations. What is he supposed to do, just not talk to him? Or at what point should he stop talking to him?
Well, Justice Dockham, I don't have a problem with him talking to him. It's what he said when he talked to him. So telling him, reassuring him, that they could resolve this informally is what disarmed him, is what lulled him into cooperating and producing documents without formal discovery.
Well, what about the entry of default didn't alarm him? You're saying he didn't get alarmed until the motion for entry of default judgment, but default was entered before that.
Right.
Does the record reflect why he didn't come forward right then?
Other than what I've explained, Justice Nakayama, no, it doesn't, but I think what's a bigger question is, why did they wait 7 months to file a motion for default judgment?
And so, I mean, that's kind of a curious argument to blame them for not acting quicker. I mean, because in one sense, one could think if during that 7 months, your client had the opportunity to move to set it aside. And if there had been a motion to set aside before the motion for default judgment, I think your client may have been in a better position.
Justice Pollack, you're absolutely correct, and that's part of my argument. So we as litigators know when a default is entered, the sooner you move to set it aside, the easier it is. We also know that when there's an extended period of time between default and a motion to set aside, it's much harder. And so whether it was intentional or not, they used this period of 7 months against him. And the ICA, actually, when they issued their decision, said part of their reasoning for upholding Judge Chang's decision was there was a seven-month delay between the entry of default and the motion to set aside interest.
But under that analysis, if they had waited 2 or 3 years, then your client would even be in a better position. Because you're holding the length of time in favor of your client.
I'm saying that the length of time can't or should not be used as a sword by the plaintiff, is what I'm saying.
Well, Mr. King didn't contact Dr. Waugh between the time of after the complaint was filed. Is that correct?
Well, not according to my client. That he believes there were communications. I don't have support in the record for
There's no record of any communications, and as a matter of fact, in his email to him, he said, I'm filing the complaint, or I'm recommending it to my client that file the complaint, get a lawyer. So first you're faulting Mr. King for talking to your client, and then are you saying that he should have told him after he filed the complaint and after default was entered? He should have contacted him and told him you better do something? You're not saying that, right?
Well, in a way, Justice Nakayama, I am, based on his prior communications where he's saying we can resolve this informally.
Well, he told him to get a lawyer. What else is he supposed to do?
Well, that's the thing. If you look at, so, and I think you have to look at this from a layperson's standpoint. If you look at that email that you're referencing, it's a very long email. And, I mean, I honestly, true story, I've actually told Mr. King when we've communicated that I don't read his emails because they're too long.
Well, Mr. King, wouldn't you fault him for if he continued to communicate with your client after the complaint was filed and he told him to get a lawyer?
I would not.
Isn't that problematic?
If he were to communicate with him after he, first of all, if he tells him, like the record shows, let's resolve this informally, cooperate with me, and then he files a complaint and serves it, and then he contacts him afterwards and says, look, you need to hire a lawyer, we're no longer in informal discussions, okay, that would be a problem for us, but the record doesn't show that.
Mr. Blunzik, can you turn to the other issues in the case, which, aside from the default, which of the issues would you like to highlight? Of course, the fiduciary relationship, corporate bail, what do you think the trial court would call?
All of the above, Justice Reckonwall, starting with the issue of a fiduciary relationship. I mean, the complaint alleges that Dr. Chen and Dr. Ma's company were in an independent contractor relationship, so that's a judicial admission. And what the circuit court did, because he adopted scripted findings, was say that there was a fiduciary relationship between an independent contractor and the company that they are doing work for, and there's just no support in the law for that. Regarding the independent contractor relationship and using the use of employment law, what the circuit court did was use these issues regarding whether you can have set-offs to monies owed in an employer-employee relationship. So that's, again, the circuit court taking law that doesn't apply to an independent contractor relationship and applying it.
That analysis all applies to the claims other than the contract claim that the court entered default judgment on, correct?
They apply to Chief Justice, they apply to almost all of them because all of the claims are basically alleging the same thing. That
the court entered default judgment. So after there's an entry of default and then there's litigation about whether there's going to be a trial on damages, and I thought there was an entry of default judgment on the contract damages.
But that's partly correct. There was a trial all of the damages were related to basically all of the claims that remained alive. And regarding also
my question is, if there was a properly entered default judgment, and if I understand correctly, the tort damages and other damages were in the same amount, even if we agreed with you on these issues, why would it support setting aside the judgment on the default judgment?
Well, it wouldn't. If you found that, for example, the fraud claim was legitimate, then it wouldn't. I think you're correct. Although I will say, just going back briefly to the issue of the meritorious defense, the fact that the circuit court, after a quote-unquote trial on damages, found that several of those claims were not sufficient and dismissed them is pretty rock-solid evidence that there was a meritorious defense, at least those claims that were dismissed.
Yeah, but the Chief Justice asked you about, I think, the contract claim.
I'm not talking about the contract claim. So the claims, there were several claims that were dismissed, including count 4, conversion, count 10, constructive trust, where Judge Chang had a hearing and said these claims are insufficient. So, but what I'm saying is that's what he should have done when the motion for entry of default was filed. That was part of his job, part of his analysis, should have included that. And regarding the last two issues, this claim should have been against Dr. Ma DDS Inc. And the company employed her as an independent, used her as an independent contractor. What the judge did basically was do an end run around the alter ego piercing corporate veil theory by holding Dr. Ma individually liable for everything. And there was no finding whatsoever that he was personally liable for the debts of the corporation. That was a pretty clear error by the circuit court.
Well, but that's because default was entered as to liability, right?
It was, yes. Yes, just
right.
Yes,
so why would there be a separate finding when default had already been entered as to the liability of Dr. Ma individually?
I think it goes back to my belief at the start of this that the circuit court should have an obligation to go through the legal analysis. Whether or not someone raises it or not, they shouldn't be able to ignore the law. And the last issue is this scripted findings. I mean, it's not the biggest issue, and I don't know if you're going to address it or not. I see it a lot. And if you look at the findings that were issued in this case, it's a definition of scripted. They were submitted to him. They were signed by Judge Chang without any alterations whatsoever. They're very inflammatory. It's basically a trial brief. And I just think it's inappropriate for circuit court judges to do that. And I would hope that the court would weigh in on that issue. I think I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, whatever it is, for rebuttal.
We'll hear from Mr. Cannon.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Dennis King. I represent the respondent, plaintiff appellee, Dr. Grace Chen, who is present here in the courtroom today. If I could briefly, I'd just like to hit the last couple of points that Mr. Valencia mentioned. I'll largely rely on my briefs with regard to those last three points. As far as scripted findings and conclusions go, Judge Chang, about 2 weeks after the trial on November 10 of 2014, rendered his oral ruling on the case. That was his decision. I took his decision and his findings, and I put those into the findings of fact that were later entered about 2 years later. He also allowed us to amplify on what he said. So the ultimate findings, although they're derived from the nucleus of what Judge Chang said, I've expanded on them. And with regard to these three points, they weren't necessarily the things that Judge Chang hung his hat on. But with regard to personal liability, they continually try to argue that there's some piercing of the corporate veil. We never argued that theory. We were saying that Dr. Ma acted in his own capacity and at the same time was acting on behalf of the corporation. So that's why he was found liable for fraud and misrepresentation in his own capacity individually. So their arguments, I think, are misplaced. They also argue that there cannot be, as a matter of law, a fiduciary duty in an independent contractor relationship. Now, again, Judge Chang didn't hang his hat on that, but we cited cases that came from the employment context, but they all dealt with a set of facts where you've got one person who controls documents. The other person is supposed to be paid based upon those documents and calculations that are determined from them. That person is dependent upon the one who's got the documents and does the calculations. That creates a limited fiduciary duty. And that's what we've argued here, and that's exactly what the facts were. But there are other grounds for the court's holding. So I'll pass on those points and go to the main issue that the court's looking at. At the time that this issue was decided by Judge Chang, the practice in the circuit court, and for the number of years that I was practicing, was if there was a default, and I'm focusing now on an entry of a default, not a default judgment, you had to meet the BDM stage code standards. Now, granted, the Rule 55C, says that the test is good cause, but I can't tell you the derivation or the origin of how it developed from good cause to three elements in the BDM case.
Well, is it possible that what BDM seemed to rely on was the federal rule, which is actually different than Hawaii's rule?
It is slightly different. I'll agree with you. There are slight differences.
Rule 55 under the federal rule incorporates the Rule 60 directly. It's quite a difference.
That's true. But here we weren't dealing with a default judgment. They didn't appeal, actually, the entry of the default judgment. They appealed the entry of the default. So the default judgment was never challenged, at least on appeal. So if we look at what existed at the time that Judge Chang was looking at this, this is not a case where you had a defendant who came to court and presented admissible evidence on a meritorious defense and at the same time showed that
a standard? Is that a new kind of a nuance that not only do you have to show a meritorious defense, but the judge has to determine in this hearing that it's admissible evidence? Is this like is this sort of like a summary judgment? It's such an awkward proceeding that this rule or this BDM seems to contemplate.
I think if you look at the federal cases, and I haven't scrutinized the language in every state court case, but I think what you have to have at a minimum, first of all, it's not a summary judgment standard. There's no cases that say that that's the standard.
I understand.
But I think what you do have to have, based on the cases, is one, admissible evidence. Rule 101 of why rules of evidence say that these rules apply in proceedings in the circuit court. Rule 43E of the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure says that if the court's going to consider facts outside of the record, you have to submit affidavits. Well, those affidavits have to have admissible evidence. And I think the federal cases are very clear. You need admissible evidence. That's the first thing. And here, there wasn't admissible evidence on a number of the key things that Dr. Ma was saying, and I can come to those in a minute. The second thing I think you have to have, according to what some of the federal cases say, is the position that's presented with regard to a meritorious defense has to be logical and legally plausible. Now, you don't have to prove it with preponderance.
We've rejected plausibility even on a 12B6. So I just want to ask you, what happened between October and May?
Exactly what you've seen in the record with regard to what was filed in the lawsuit. That's it. There was nothing else, and that's why there isn't anything in any.
And the record shows what, some discovery requests?
Yes. When the complaint was filed, Dr. Ma was also served with a document request. That's Exhibit 1.
And did you receive those?
No, I didn't. That was the key. The whole key to this case is not producing the accounting documents. If you look back in the findings of fact that were finally entered at trial, my client on November of 2011 stopped receiving backup for her checks. Before that, for 2.5 years, she'd get a check, and it would have a correlation to the work she did for which client, and then it would deduct 50% of her lab fees and 40% of money that didn't come in for her work. That was the standard practice. That stopped on November 5th of 2011. That's in the findings of fact. Then in June of 2012, so from that date in 11 to 2012, she kept trying to contact Dr. Ma to explain to him, hey, I'm not getting any backup, and I don't think I'm getting paid what I'm owed. I'm putting in a lot of work, and I'm not getting payments. But
she had gotten like about $360,000 in 2011, but by 2012,
it significantly dropped. In fact,
like,
from her,
yeah, 89,000 or something.
She was generating up to $1.4 million, and he was receiving 60% of that. And his own time started to decline for what he was putting in. But she couldn't reach him. And there's a series of exhibits that were submitted at the trial where she's constantly sending text messages and emails trying to get him to meet with him. She even set up an appointment to have her teeth worked on by Dr. Ma so she could get in front of him. They worked on different days in the office, both from Honolulu to Hilo. So she never could meet him. So she set up an appointment to have her teeth worked on so she could talk to him about the fact she wasn't getting these records and no support. And he started working on her teeth and she couldn't talk to him.
Mr. King, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're kind of describing what I think you would consider to be the robust nature of the record, where she is attempting to get records and not getting it, right?
Correct.
Now, Mr. Valencia, I think, is making the point that there was a tremendous amount of interaction and communication between Mr. Ma and your client that preceded the filing of the complaint. So why wouldn't that be an indication that there actually was an understanding on the part of Dr. Ma that there was negotiations underway and that, and from Dr. Ma's point of view, the complaint, I guess Mr. Valencia's point is, it was just another stage in this negotiation.
Well, the negotiation supposedly picked up when I came into the case, and that's when I sent the demand letter in September of 2012 to try and get the records that my client wasn't able to get. In fact, in the findings of fact of trial, it shows that in June of 2012, Dr. Ma stopped allowing the dental associates to come in, said he was going to do an accounting and provide the records to the CPAs for the dental associates. My client tried to get them, couldn't get them. By September, so by the end of...
But so you're reciting a long history of how hard you were trying...
Yes.
How hard your efforts were to get the records. But I think Mr. Valencia is saying, yes, there was also this communication going on there where you were still in discussion about producing documents so you could resolve the case.
Well, that went up till October 3 of 2012. So when I sent my demand letter, I never expected Dr. Ma to call me back. I think in all the time I've been practicing, that almost never happens. But he called. And so my duty is to try to get those documents to see if we can work this out and establish how much my client is owed. So I documented the discussions because of what I had heard from my client about Dr. Ma beforehand. There's no reply email from him. There's no denial by him in his declaration that those things that I stated happened. And the last one on October 3rd, I told him, we've hit an impasse. At that point, he was saying, I'm not going to produce these documents unless you pay a dollar a page for 3,000 to 6,000 pages of documents. It was just unaffordable for my client. We had provided an alternative, which is send them over to a copier center over in Hilo. They would pick them up. The chain of custody would be kept from them back to Dr. Ma's office, and we would pay directly to the copier. He wasn't willing to do that. So at that point, we had reached an impasse. I told him that. If you look at my emails, more than one time that I mentioned to him to have his attorney contact me. So when he says that he didn't know he should get an attorney, he clearly told me that he had spoken to an attorney friend, didn't want to pay the expenses for having to hire an attorney. He chose to do this on his own. So when they argue he's an ignorant pro se person, that's not true. He's a highly educated individual who made a decision, a willful act, not to be represented at that point. And there's nothing in my communications after October 3rd that could have left any person of reasonable judgment to think that we're still negotiating something. I've told them that we're going to have to, I'm recommending my client to go to court. We're at an impasse. Have your attorney contact me. Within a week, we file a complaint. We serve it on him. He's now been served with a complaint. There's nothing in his declaration saying what he did in response to that. He did nothing. And the reason I think the inference is strong in light of the history that he did nothing is because he knew he controlled the documents. Without the documents, my client couldn't prove her damages. So he controlled them before when she tried to get them, he controlled them when I tried to get them, and even after the court process started, he continued to control them until months later when he saw, uh-oh, a motion for default judgment has been filed, and in fact, they've extrapolated out the income to come up with a way to calculate damages. Now, Judge Chang denied that motion. They were allowed to file an opposition, and he denied it because he wasn't convinced on the numbers. But we had come up with a method to calculate the damages at that point, and so he decided that he was going to try to set it aside. But I think if you look at the elements of the test, the BDM test, even if you go to good cause and you say, well, you don't need a meritorious defense, I don't think there was any meritorious defense presented. First of all, he had no admissible evidence to support it. They referred to a declaration from Gloria Thompson. She was a patient and an accountant of Dr. Ma.
Let's suppose hypothetically we apply the standard that's in the rule, which is good cause. Can this court make a determination as to whether, if that's the standard we think is appropriate, and that the court should have done it, is this court in a position to make a determination as to whether or not good cause was demonstrated, or is that something that must be done at least at the first part or as a first instance by the actual court? In other words, can we apply a standard that the court did not and reach a determination?
I think that the test here is whether or not Judge Chang abused his discretion in applying what he believed was the standard. I don't think there was an abuse. So if you change the standard or say that those cases that people, judges were looking at before is not the correct standard, then I think it's got to go back to him for a determination. But I think that it's not appropriate to go back now, because even if you look at good cause, clearly under the two prongs that weren't met on BDM here, we're saying no meritorious defense. But if you say the only thing you got to show is whether there was a lack of excusable neglect, on that he fails too.
But is excusable, you know, in fact, I'm asking this question, but excusable neglect and good cause are not the same thing.
Well, the question is, are they or are they not? I think that they come so close that they really would be one and the same, because otherwise...
But our cases have said with excusable neglect that ignorance of the law can never... I mean, it seems to me, reading our cases, we feel that they're not the same standard. And in fact, the rules aren't interchangeable in that respect. Are they, or is that what your argument is?
Well, you can't sleep on your rights and do nothing and then finally say, I'm here now, set aside default. It's not set aside by demand. You have to show good cause. And what is the good cause in the record that they have? Nothing until a motion to set aside default is filed.
Well, While you're on that point, perhaps you could respond directly to Mr. Valencia's recitation of the position that was taken at the hearing on the motion to set aside the entry of default, and that position was clearly Mr. Ma said he didn't owe the money. He didn't concede.
Well, this
why wouldn't that be sufficient good cause? The defendant appears and says, I didn't commit the acts that are alleged.
I think that takes us back to meritorious defenses. All he's doing
is... Now, I think you have a good point there, but I thought our discussion had to do with Justice Pollack's point that if we consider good cause to be different than the standard under 60B, it's not necessary to go through the three criteria that have been previously applied, and I understand that it would be something of a change, but the Segeco case, I think, could be analyzed as though it's applying a standard that would be a 60B standard as opposed to the standard for setting aside entry of default. So I thought that's what we are discussing. If you just look at good cause without a definition of the three-step standard, why isn't that enough to just simply show up and say, I have a defense, I don't agree that I owe the money?
Well, I think you're back to admissible evidence. That's a conclusion. It's a conclusory statement in a complaint.
Well, I mean, for the defendant to testify and explain why he doesn't think he owes the sum that's being demanded, you could admit, I think, is admissible evidence.
Well, then in that case, every defendant who's tardy can come in and seek to set aside a default, no matter how late they are, by just saying, I deny the liability in the case. And that's tantamount to set aside by demand.
All right, that's why I'm asking you that question. So your position is that essentially that's the same thing as just showing up and saying, I'm sorry?
I think so. I think he has to have some admissible evidence, not just a conclusion that I don't owe it. But I'd also like to point out that even in a default situation, he's allowed to challenge the damages, right? There's clear case law on that. And, in fact, he was allowed to do that at the first default judgment and a year later at the second default
sure.
judgment.
Sure. I mean, he had an opportunity to address damages, just not his claim that he actually wasn't liable.
Yes. So I think that he needs something more, and he really didn't have anything that was admissible at that time to be able to show other than I deny that I owe it. Now, ultimately, he lost at trial after he had his day in court. So my argument would be, even if this was set aside, it's harmless error because he had an opportunity to oppose the first default motion for default judgment. And
harmless error when liability has been imposed and he hasn't. I mean, it's one thing to argue, and I understand your argument. Look at this record. Even if you apply good cause, he didn't need it. But it's quite another to say that when liability is imposed, that it's harmless because there's been no decision on the merits in terms of all these cases. I mean,
in this case, there was a decision on the merits at trial on fraud and misrepresentation. The judge didn't just accept the fact that there was a default and we assume liability. He required all the evidence to be presented and made a determination that there was clear and convincing evidence supporting Judge Chen's position that she was defrauded. One of the key issues was whether or not she was offered a partnership in this practice. Her position was she was. Dr. Ma said, I never offered a position. So we presented witnesses showing his own employees that, in fact, they overheard him say to her that he was offering this partnership. In addition, we presented a doctor who had worked for him before who was offered the same thing. Ultimately, Dr. Ma never presented the partnership papers, and that dentist left in frustration and was still owed money when he left. We presented a number of documents to show and witnesses to refute Dr. Ma. He was impeached. His credibility was found not to be trustworthy.
And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to get you to clarify that point. Is it your view that the record shows a finding by the trial judge that Dr. Ma was not credible?
Correct. In fact, if you look at the conclusions of law, paragraph D through P of the findings that were entered,
A good portion of those were actually taken from Judge Chang's decision on November 10, 2014, which is in the transcript for that day, where he made these specific findings that Dr. Ma was not credible, and he listed evidence supporting that. So the finding at trial was not just based upon a liability determination based on default. All the evidence was presented.
So that your position is, although purportedly a trial on damages, in fact it was a trial on liability, or was that expressly understood by everyone? That, not clear to me why, if you have an entry of default, you're going to go back and retry the whole case. Is that just how it played out?
I think that that's how it played out. And I tried two times on motions for default judgment to prevail on those two counts, fraud and misrepresentation. I didn't succeed, and the judge wanted a trial on it. So it was a full-blown trial. Dr. Ma got to present his arguments and defenses with regard to whether or not he ever offered a partnership. So what I'm saying is it indeed is harmless error here. He had his day in court and had an opportunity to contest liability and damages on this, and he lost.
Actually, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
On the default judgment, he has not appealed the default judgment, so that on the contract, which had the same damages as the fraud, that's, in essence, unless we find that the default entry should be set aside, are we done on that issue?
That's correct. That was contract as against his company, and detrimental reliance or promissory estoppel as against him personally. But those were the findings in that motion. It wasn't appealed.
That was the entry of default judgment.
Correct.
Yes. So he entered default judgment as to certain counts, but you're saying that the trial as to conversion, constructive trust, fraud,
and misrepresentation.
And misrepresentation was a full-blown trial on the merits also. And he affirmed the damages. He awarded the same damages as he had on the motion for default judgment as to the other counts.
That's
is
correct.
That right?
And I was going to put my CPA on Dwayne Seabolt at trial to put on the damages, and the defense counsel stipulated to not needing to put on his testimony in light of what had already been ruled on default judgment. And on the two counts, constructive trust and the other one that you mentioned, those were denied to us on grounds of the law, according to Judge Chang after the trial. So even in this case, if you were to establish, you might say, a new interpretation of Rule 55C as to what good cause means in the context of setting aside an entry of default, I think that at least in this case, it's harmless error what Judge Chang, if you were to find that somehow he abused his discretion in utilizing the BDM case and looking at both of the elements of meritorious defense as well as the second one on the lack of excusable neglect. We think that he properly considered the issues. Granted, he asked defense counsel at the hearing, what are your meritorious defenses? And defense counsel right away went to fraud. But if you look at their memo in opposition, their motion to set aside entry of default, that's the focus in it also. It's the fraud claim and arguing essentially, we don't owe anything. There's no damages. And again, they weren't foreclosed from challenging any of the damage issues, even by the entry of default. If that was primarily their claim that there was overpayment to my client.
Why would that theory establish a defense as to all the claims?
Well, is that
ruling that Judge Chang supported in essence? Hey, we don't owe any money to the dispute. We think she owes us money. That's our defense. And it kind of works. Doesn't that really theory work for all of the counts?
Well, I understand what you're saying because damages are always an element of every one of the counts. But the first count was accounting, and so that's not necessarily damages. We were trying to get documents. But as a general rule, you would say that. But here, again, no admissible evidence other than his conclusion, I don't owe anything. The declaration from Gloria Thompson was really inadmissible. Bear in mind, under Rule 1006 of the Rules of Evidence, if you're presenting a summary, you've got to have all your backup documents to support that. That's what I couldn't get. If you look at my emails, Exhibits 1 through 8, attached to our memo in opposition to the entry of default, I was telling Dr. Ma, you've now given me a declaration from Ms. Thompson. Where's the backup? Because all that was numbers. And, in fact, it admitted that my client was underpaid for some of the years. Within a year, she provided another one as we were getting closer to trial, but, again, no backup. So she had two different declarations. Those are referenced in our brief to the ICA. Had different numbers, but again, no backup. There's just You got to have admissible evidence, I think, as a starting point. So that declaration, I think, gets thrown out. And then if you look at his argument, well, we paid her this money, and we overpaid her. Back in 2008, 9, and 10, since you're suing for 11 and 12, we want to get our money back now. And my position is you've got the presumption under the rules of evidence, right? That is, the money that's paid to a person, this is Rule 303C1, money delivered by one to another is presumed to have been due to the latter. And, in fact, we presented a line of cases, the Godoy case and several other Hawaii cases, that once a party has voluntarily made payments to someone, they don't have an obligation to be able or a right to get that back if they later made a mistake and that person has relied upon receiving that money. And that's what we had here. So legally, and that's why I was saying that at least you've got to have a material defense, and that material defense has to be based on admissible evidence that's legally plausible. It's not legally plausible in light of this presumption and also the Hawaii case law that says voluntary payments, you don't get those back.
So all of this, as I asked earlier, would all apply even if you had your house burned down. That's under the standard, the BDM standard, that you have to come in and show a viable, meritorious defense, independent of having a house burned down or having a horrible accident.
Well, fortunately, that's not this case. And so I can't give you any insight on how to decide that case that's not before us. But in this case, the house didn't burn down. My client was deprived of compensation that she's been trying to get for 5 years now. And we think that the judge, at least based on the standards that applied at the time, did not abuse his discretion. And we don't think that this, setting this aside and sending it back to the trial court is really going to advance the interests, certainly not of the parties here, and I don't think of the state of the law, because this is not the set of facts that you would, I think, want to make a change in the interpretation of Rule 55C. Bad facts will create bad law, and this would be the bad fact case.
Actually, that principle, in a sense, to me, works opposite. In certain ways, it could be interpreted exactly the difference, but I don't want to. In other words, because the facts theoretically may not be sympathetic, therefore you don't apply it. In any event, thank you.
Anything further, Mr. King?
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Sometimes I'm a little slow on the uptake, so I apologize for that, but what I think I hear you saying is that you want to apply the good cause standard instead of the three-factor test in BDM. And if that's your position, I'm good with that. I think the issue is, though, when you look at the rule and it says that you will apply good cause as set forth in 60B, 60B doesn't really give you
that's
enough.
Not what it says.
That's not what it says.
Read the rule closely, which apparently BDM did not. When does it refer you to Rule 60?
May. For good cause shown, the court may set aside entry of default, and if judgment by default has been entered, may likewise set it aside. Oh, I see. Yes, you're correct. So your question is whether or not that 60B standard should apply to setting aside entry of default in addition to default judgment.
And in here, it was a motion, there was no motion to set aside default. It was a motion to set aside default judgment, right?
No, Justice Nakayama, it was a motion to set aside the entry of default.
Oh, it was. I thought Mr. King said that, well, he's supposing, I guess, that the reason that your client stood up and took notice was that on the motion for entry of judgment, there's actually a dollar figure that was put in that made your client kind of alarmed.
In the motion for default judgment, they asked for, I think, about $274,000. But that's what spurred my client to realize that, okay, I need to hire a lawyer after all these discussions with Mr. King. But there was a motion to set aside entry of default by my client. It's not a motion to set aside the default judgment.
Mr. Valencia,
yes.
The theme that, correct me if I'm wrong, you seem to be proposing is that your client did not get his opportunity to have his day in court and present evidence that would have otherwise been available to him that could have caused him to prevail. Could you explain what you mean by that? What evidence didn't you get to present? What is it that you feel would have caused the decision to be different in terms of liability?
Justice Wilson, I think from the start of the case, if he would have been allowed to file an answer and a counterclaim, he lost that opportunity.
Oh, I'm assuming that in this question. Let's assume that case is remanded, there's a new trial, all the discovery you need. Help me. Well, what does that case look like? What would you feel you'd be able to do that you weren't permitted to do here in terms of presenting evidence?
Everything that I would normally do as a litigator. So first of all, we would file an answer.
I didn't mean procedurally. I'm talking about the substance. It appears that you are saying that Dr. Ma didn't get a chance, for example, to testify. Is that what you're saying?
No, Justice Wilson, I'm not saying that.
Did he get an opportunity to present evidence? Yes, of course he did. There was an extended proceeding. So that's what I'm reaching for, the actual specifics of what evidence are you concerned about that you need to present next time?
Well, I think, first of all, he had one hand tied behind his back because he was told you can only present evidence as to damages, not liability.
So you disagree with Mr. King's belief that the portrayal of what happened is effectively a trial on.
Absolutely, by Judge Chang's own express words, that this was a trial on. He told him specifically he was going to have a trial on damages only, not on liability. So. CJ, I would say no, because in part because of what I was mentioning earlier about a counterclaim, because if there would have been a chance for Dr. Ma to file a counterclaim, the case would have been it would have looked entirely different.
Was there a demand for jury trial?
Yes, Justice Paul.
Was there ever a waiver?
There must have been. I don't know the
answer. Who demanded jury trial?
I'm sorry. I don't think there was a waiver because there was a default. So,
right.
Yeah.
So.
No, but... Oh, there was a demand for jury trial. You still have a right to do jury trial on damages.
Yeah, I was not involved with the underlying proceedings, so I don't know exactly what happened with the jury trial. So I don't know if at some point it was waived or what.
Assuming, Mr. Valencia, that we decide that good cause is the standard, what in the record shows good cause that Judge Chang should have?
I think if you look at three things in particular, one is the declaration that Mr. King filed. It's Record on Appeal Volume 1, starting at 160, where he says, attached hereto as Exhibit 14 is a true and correct copy of a demand letter that I sent on September 10th, 2012 to Defendant Jonathan Ma, DDS. Although he called me in response to my demand letter, despite multiple follow-up telephone conversations by me, demanding Dr. Chen's accounting records, I'm skipping, Dr. Ma never produced copies of the complete accounting documents. So this is where I think the record is unclear and there is doubt regarding whether there were communications after October, because he said there were multiple follow-up telephone discussions. And he also says complete records. So in other words, records were produced. So default is for someone who has given someone the stiff arm and said, look, I'm not dealing with this. I'm not going to defend.
Wait. Default is for people who don't answer.
Well, Justice Pollack, I don't think it's that simple. So I think it's for someone who decided that they're not just not answer, but they're just not responding. So what we have here is someone who's actually having conversations, producing documents, and those are not the actions of someone who doesn't want to try and resolve the dispute. That's clearly what.
But nothing was produced after the complaint was served, correct? Although there was demand for additional documents, backup documents, or documents.
Justice McKenna, the way it broke down was they offered to produce the documents that Mr. King was asking for. They were going to charge him $1 a page. He balked at that. Dr. Ma offered to allow him to come in and review the documents personally. He refused. He wanted them scanned to him. That never happened. That's how the discussions broke down.
Well, I think maybe you're trying to address this, but perhaps you could use this as an opportunity to respond to the finding that the court made as to your client's obligations to respond? Because the court specifically said the record only shows that the defendant was avoiding his obligations under the law to respond to the complaint in a timely fashion. So you're welcome to explain why that was not accurate.
It's not accurate, Justice Wilson, I think because of the context, and that's where I talked about earlier, starting in the middle of the story. I think you have to go back to the discussions that they were having with each other. And
so all three of your reasons that you said you were going to put forth for a good cause all have to do with communications between Dr. Ma and Mr. King. Are those all the good cause, three good cause reasons?
No, Justice Nakayama, I think also the defenses that he raised as well, and the declaration of Gloria Thompson, the accountant that he hired, who did her own analysis.
With a good cause for not answering the complaint.
Oh, for not answering, okay.
Isn't that what we're talking, not for the setting aside of default, good cause why the default should not, why the default should be set aside. That's all we're looking at.
Well, if the standard is good cause without any, without tied to Rule 60, and it's sort of just a more amorphous term, then I think we can argue whatever we think is relevant. And I think the fact that he had a defense on liability is relevant. The fact that he was working with Gloria Thompson before the complaint was filed and having Gloria Thompson compile information and do an analysis out of his own pocket and provided that analysis to the
Is there anything in the record that indicates that Gloria Thompson was working on the analysis between October and May?
Her analysis was completed before then, Your Honor.
So completed before October?
It was. It was completed and provided to them, and they didn't like it. That's what happened.
All right. But and so then he was served with a complaint. He didn't answer.
Right.
Default was entered. Nothing happened.
Maybe, because my
what does the record show? Does the record show anything happened other than default was entered up until the time of judgment, a motion for entry of judgment?
The record neither confirms nor denies that there were communications between the parties after
the record does not show any communications, correct?
It doesn't show anything.
Right.
Right. It doesn't,
so it does not confirm any communication.
You're right. It doesn't confirm.
Your client could have brought forth evidence of communication between October and May or June when he filed his motion.
Back in the lower court proceedings, he could have.
Or activity or discovering being produced or things. And there's nothing. According to, counsel, there's no discovery that was produced despite the production request that was served along with a complaint.
I don't think that's entirely accurate because documents were produced, and including not just documents.
Wait, where?
Oh, no, not after October 3rd, but they were produced before October 3rd.
Does the record reflect any response to the request for production of documents?
No, CJ, it doesn't. No, but I do want to just read to you this.
And I would say we have gone over your time, but
thank you, Chief Justice. Dr. Ma's declaration, paragraph 34, volume 1, at 288 of the record. He says, I was induced by Mr. King's assurances of resolving this matter without litigation. Coupled with the flexible and ever-changing deadlines to comply with their request, I was misled and confused into believing that there was still time to resolve this matter informally. In retrospect, I believe that Mr. King took an unfair advantage of my situation and that I was not represented by counsel. And I think that's the context that I've been talking about and the lulling that I've been talking about. And this is not the typical situation where someone's served with a complaint and they just don't answer. It's someone who is actually affirmatively trying to resolve this dispute before, as the record shows for sure, before October 2012. Numerous conversations, 2.7 hours of conversation, 37 minutes of conversation on the date the complaint was filed. So I think that all has to be taken into consideration, and I would respectfully ask you to allow Dr. Ma to have his day in court, allow me to represent him in the circuit court and assert a counterclaim. Thank you.
Anything further at this time?
No, CJ.
All right, thank you both of our attorneys and court for this matter.
Eku ilona, please rise. Ua ho'omalolo ia mai nei kea aha ho'o kolo kolo kie kie hano hano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.